Everyone, and I have a couple, one announcement. I think is that I'll be away for most of the month of July. For now, at the month of July, I'll be back. I think the last Sunday of July, and then the other Sundays, Taraniya, Gloria Ambrosia, who's a marvelous Dharma teacher, is going to come and be kind of, in some ways, our first resident teacher. Ajahn Sundara maybe was the first. She was here for 10 days. But Taraniya will be here for a whole month, and she will do all the teachings, except for that last Sunday in July. She'll do all the Mondays and all the Sundays and all the Thursdays, and a one-day sitting and a half-day sitting. And she's also going to make herself available for interviews to talk about the meditation practice or your practice. And I think it would be wonderful to meet with her, and probably 15-minute interviews of some sort, as I guess. And Judith is the primary, right? Sorry? Right. So Judith and Audrey are the official hosts for IMC, kind of taking care of her and hosting her and being the connection between us and her, whatever needs to be taken care of. So... But next Sunday, it'll be Blanche Hartman who will come and speak. And Blanche is the abbess of San Francisco Zen Center. And she was here for our opening, and an old friend and dear woman. Next week is the children's program we have at 9:15 or so until the potluck time. And... nothing, that's it. The usual mic we have here, which sits kind of unobtrusively on my shirt, is I guess needs to be repaired. And so we have this imposing thing in front of me here. And it worked out really well yesterday during the one-day sitting, because in the afternoon I got a little bit sleepy. And so I was sitting here and... and because it kept so close, I couldn't go very far. So I don't think I'll fall asleep on you talking. There was a Kobin Shino, who is a Dharma teacher, who taught in Los Altos and around this area since, I think, the late 60s. Wonderful Japanese Zen teacher. When he first came to America from Japan, he was practicing and teaching at Tassajara in the 67, 68. And he gave a Dharma talk where he fell asleep in his own Dharma talk. And I've always taken that to be a very good sign. That he was so detached, so relaxed about his own Dharma talk, what people would think and what their concern is, that he could even fall asleep in his own talk. It was partly his English wasn't so good, and so I think there were long pauses while he was waiting for the next English words to come. He'd also spent the day using a chainsaw, so I think he was probably pretty exhausted. So I was struck during the sitting here how, certainly how nice it is to sit, and I was kind of very conscious of silence and the stillness and then the noise in my mind. And... and there were layers and, activity, thoughts, my mind, and how at some point it seemed like it was noise, it's the, compared to the silence that was there. And so what is it that helps us to enter the silence more completely, or to be more at peace with this world that we live in? The insight meditation tradition puts a lot of emphasis on the value of insight, and it's our name, Insight Meditation Center. And people often want to know, what does insight mean? And some people assume that it means kind of psychoanalytic insights, or psychological insights into how we personally work. We finally understood, why I always say those kinds of things, because when I was 20 years old, someone said something to me, and it was, now I understand. And it tends to be kind of, sometimes we refer to insights as being kind of insights into our personal biography and history and how that makes us be who we are. In the Buddhist tradition, the word insight goes beyond that to include, or to actually be more specific, to include insight into that which is universal, the universal aspects of our experience. And in particular, there are three characteristics of our experience which the tradition puts tremendous emphasis on. And that is, and these are the three primary insights, and they are that everything's impermanent, all experience are impermanent, everything we experience is characterized in some way or other by being dukkha, by being unsatisfactory, but by suffering. And the third insight is that most of the things we take to be our experience, or all the things that we can experience, don't qualify as being a self, as being the self. Impermanence, not self, and suffering. Now, in kind of popular English, sometimes this is translated into kind of a little bit offhand kind of way, as life will put you through changes, it hurts, but don't take it personally. And this idea of not taking it personally is kind of what I want to focus on today. And not taking things personally is one of the ways to help us be more at peace in ourselves, in our minds, to align ourselves more fully with a great silence or stillness, which is can be so satisfying. And I was sitting recently and meditating, and I was kind of merrily not meditating. I was lost in my thoughts and kind of consumed or preoccupied with my thinking for a while during the sitting. And then at some point I woke up to that, and I was aware that that was what was going on. And there was a very interesting shift that happened once I became awake to that what was going on, was that I no longer saw my thoughts, those thoughts, a train of thinking, as being me. I was somehow, I was the observer watching that, but that'd be okay to say, you know, I was the observation, the observer was kind of watching this train of thoughts. And those train of thoughts were no longer tied into my self-definition. I wasn't taking them personally. And also I wasn't entangled with them. Until then, when I was lost in those thoughts, preoccupied, who I was and those thoughts were inseparable. Not that I was thinking that way, just that that's kind of my whole sense of self was tied or connected to thinking, because thinking was what was going on. And often we define ourselves through our thoughts, maybe not consciously, but we think we are what we think. And so, you know, we think certain things, we believe what I think must be true. The way I perceive or think about the world must be the true way of seeing the world. And so, because what else could be truer than my own thoughts? Our thoughts tell us stories about who we are or who we shouldn't be. And our thoughts create a kind of world of self, world of others. And it's not that often that we step outside of the flow of those thoughts to see, you know, actually maybe I'm more than that, or I'm not that. It's much more satisfying for some people to think I'm more than that, because then you're not, you know, but we're more than that, we're not that. There's another part of who we are, which is not the flow of thoughts, not what we think. Even if you have the most horrible thought or the most noble thought about yourself or about others, and to realize that that doesn't actually define who you are or define who others are. It's always going to be, any kind of self-definition is going to be limited, because there's always more to that. There's always something which is beyond in terms of the self, I would think. And many of us know what it's like to be defined in some fixed way by others. We've done something in the past, and they've defined, you know, and they hold us to that definition. You know, you get angry with someone once, and they always see you that way. Or they see you as someone's spouse, and they always see you in that category. You know, don't see you as who you actually are. Or they see you as a certain, you know, nationality, or a certain ethnic group, or a certain gender, or a certain whatever. And people see you in that kind of category, and say, wait a minute, hey, I'm not that. You know, please don't limit me like that. Or we see it that people do it for themselves. And we say, you know, get off it. You know, you're more than that, or don't believe you're so limited, or, you know, you keep saying, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it. You know, don't limit yourself that way. You're more than that. in some way. And of course, I think it's much harder to see how we do that for ourselves, limit ourselves by a self-definition. And taking things personally and limiting ourselves by some self-definition, I think, are very closely connected phenomena. And part of the insight of insight meditation is to begin seeing things, is begin not taking things so personally. Sometimes not taking it as a personal failure when we see our shortcomings, not taking it as a personal aggrandizement to see, you know, when we have some great quality or some great achievement, not to take it so personally. It's a very common expression in English, don't take things personally. And, you know, you might probably use that expression sometimes in your own life. I didn't take it so personally. Someone said something, you know, really awful to me, and just, you know, really laid into me and told me what a terrible person I was. And I knew the person hadn't slept for 2 days and hadn't eaten and was just really stressed in her life. So I didn't take it personally. It was nothing about me. It had nothing to do about me, because I knew it was really that person was really having a hard time. So I didn't take it personally. And it's such a relief to say that or to feel that way, because then you don't have to kind of hang it on as an affront or as a criticism if you take it personally, or you don't have to take it, maybe it's true and what a terrible person I am. I didn't take it personally. Or same thing can happen to us when we do something. Sometimes if you're stressed out or, you know, really tired or hungry and you say something, sometimes people say, well, I didn't, you know, I realize why I said it, that this, because of these conditions. I didn't take it so personally that I said it. I didn't take it on as this big baggage to carry around with me. It had to do with this particular situation. You know, my wife expressed this beautifully when she went through a 3-month period of medically induced menopause, temporary menopause, that for procedures she had to get ready for. And so she had all these thoughts that she never had before. And she said, you know, this is really weird. You know, these are not my thoughts. You know, or you know, who's having these thoughts? I mean, I'm having them, of course. It wasn't like she was saying that she was, you know, tuning in to someone else's thoughts, you know, like a radio, and you change the channel. You know, suddenly she's tuned into the neighbor's thoughts. You know, it wasn't like it was not happening to her. But she didn't recognize herself in those thoughts. They were bizarre thoughts. And she said, oh, these are the hormones that are causing me to think this way. And she saw them, she didn't take them personally. Oh, you know, this is, you know, the drugs are making me, you know, causing this kind of thinking in a certain way. And she didn't take it personally. And because of that, she wasn't troubled by it. Or the story, which I've told maybe too many times, of my father, when I was about 13 or so, 14, pulled me aside and said, as you grow up, you're going to have a lot of bizarre thoughts. It happens to everyone. And don't worry about it. This is what happens. And I had never had a bizarre thought until then. or hadn't occurred to me to consider it without according to that label. But eventually I had some bizarre thoughts and I had been warned, oh, and this is a bizarre thought. I've been told people have that and I'm having it. I didn't take it so personally. And if I'd taken personally, I might have believed it, or I might have reacted to it and said, oh my God, you know, this defines who I am, and I have to hide myself, or I'm embarrassed, and whatever. But by not taking it personally, there's a lot more ease and space, and kind of, you know, it's a lot easier with things. And thinking about what we take personally, the kind of thought exercise that came to my mind is, how old would you have to be where you wouldn't have to take death personally? Does that make sense? I mean, if you died when you were 132, you know, is that a personal failing that you die? You know, you know, it's not so personal anymore. But if you die when you're 92, is it then, you know, or 62 or 42 or, you know, at what point do you not take it personally? There was kind of a interest. Tanisara Bhikkhu, the Tanjef, who was here, is a great, you know, Buddhist abbot and monk and practitioner and teacher. He introduced me to a magazine called The Onion, which I never heard before. It's a satire magazine put out, I guess, by college students originally, maybe in Wisconsin, maybe, or someplace. So I was looking through this magazine, and they had in great kind of National Enquirer kind of headlines, you know, the miracle has happened, the miracle of birth. Someone's been born, and they name some person, you know, Josephine Adeline has been born, and it's the miracle, you know. And the miracle has now happened 13 billion times. You know, I guess maybe in the history of humankind, it's been 13 billion successful births. I don't know what it is. But, you know, at some point, you know, you call it a miracle, it's happened 13 billion times. You know, it's a pretty common occurrence. So life and death, you know, are they personal occurrences? I mean, they're happening to you personally, in a sense. But what does it mean to not take it personally? Sometimes teachers will say that the common elements or the structure of what happens to most of us in our lives is common to most people. We're born. People we most love, most care for, eventually die, unless we die before them. We grow up, and growing up, it's really a struggle to grow up. There's a lot of difficulties that people have growing up, and different ages and different cultures maybe have different difficulties, but for us in the West, often it's the teenage years are often difficult for people, and not always, but often. But it starts in an early age. I mean, you know, I see my sons, I mean, friends, when they're 3 or 4 years old. They suddenly, you know, say, I don't like you, and I never want to play with you again, you know, and I'm not going to talk with you again, and you're not my friend. You know, they've been best friends, you know, until 2 minutes ago. You know, you're not my friend. And or, you know, he has his best friends he plays with, and he's involved in a triangle, you see. There's Anya and Ruben and our son Torin, and they're all best friends with each other separately. But then when they play together, it's like, you know, they don't quite, sometimes they work really well together, but when they get hungry or tired, then it doesn't work so well together, and then, you know, they one of them exclude the other one. And, you know, and so, I mean, is this a personal thing? Or is it common for kids when they grow up? They're kind of sorting out their social lives and trying to make sense of it. And we feel very lucky. We have I think we've trained or had very good situations for helping socialize our son, but this stuff still happens. Is it universal to some degree that this is what happens when we grow up and struggles we have with then dating, you know, or relationships? And I read today this morning's paper about Ann Lander. I don't know anything about Ann Lander, hardly at all. And, you know, but I just opened the newspaper and just kind of my eyes fell on this one paragraph in the middle of the article about Ann Lander, and it said that she was engaged to get married, and she went into a department store in 1938 or so and to buy part of her wedding gown. And you know the story? You read it? It's a great story. And the clerk said something like, I've met a lot of women in my life, and you're the first woman I met who I feel like I could marry. And just my luck that you're coming in here to buy your wedding clothes. But that got her attention well enough that she changed grooms. And the wedding proceeded to happen on the date that was supposed to happen, but it was with the new guy. Write to Ann Landers for advice, please. And so, you know, we have these, you know, difficulties and interpersonal things happen as we grow up. And then, you know, struggles with work and livelihood. And then friends die and move away and disappear. And then we get old, if we're lucky, I suppose. And we get sick. And, you know, and then we die. And that basic kind of structure in many ways is universal. And then we fill in with particular details, like Ann Lander's detail of her particular circumstance for her wedding. That's particular to her. You know, or particular times, you know, when our parents die. They die, you know, when we're 62 and they're 92, or they die when we're 22 and they're 42, or, you know, all kinds of, you know, details vary a little bit, but the basic structure is pretty much the same. There's a kind of a universal story to being a human being. At what point, in what aspect of that universal, you know, in looking at what's universal, Do we stop taking what happens to us completely personally? Is that possible? I've known people who've seen, who have died, or while they were dying, who thought it was a personal failing to die. Is it? Is it a personal failing to die in this culture? No. And so this idea of taking things personally, our feelings personally, are our feelings personal? They are. I mean, we have to take responsibility for them. We don't want to be aloof from them and separate from them and not recognize them. But what does it mean to take something personally in a way that is a burden and a problem? That's, I think, one of the great challenges of a mindfulness practice, is to challenge us in this question, is how do we take things personally? And is it really necessary? Is it inherent in the structure of reality, in the structure of human life, to take things so personally in this way that causes suffering? We cling to it, we hold on to it. And we do it many ways. You know, we, our belief system, and we're self-righteous about it. I believe this thing and I hold on to it. This is who, because this defines who I am in relationship to other people. The very thing I'm going to say, listen carefully now, the very thing I'm going to say now is the thing I'm going to criticize. I can't seem to get out of it, except by not saying it. That I'm troubled by those spiritual people, Buddhist practitioners, and I've done this, who define themselves in opposition to who other people are. I just did it, right? In some ways. Those people who define themselves. So the way people define themselves is by the other, who someone else is. And people do it, you know, not just in religions, all over. And sometimes it's really horrible, because you start with this great big category, all those Mahayana Buddhists, you know, they got it all wrong. Only the Theravadan Buddhists got it right. And then, well, isn't this all that, the Burmese Buddhists got it right, not the Thai Buddhists. And while it's not, you know, all the Burmese Buddhists, but it's our particular sect of Burmese Buddhism got it right, not the other sect of Burmese Buddhism. Well, it's not just, it's not just, you know, our sect, but it's these teachers in my sect who have it right, and those people have it wrong. It's not just those teachers, but it's just, you know, my teacher has it right. And in fact, I'm not even so sure about my teacher. But I have it right. And so it goes, you know, history of religions. But we take, you know, our beliefs very personally. We use it to define ourselves, and we hold on to it, and it causes a lot of suffering. So now I want to turn it over to you and ask you, what wisdom, what understandings have you come to in your life that helps you not to take things personally in a way that taking it personally is a burden, is a suffering, is a kind of wind drag as you go through your life? What has helped you understand not to take things personally? Mm-hmm. Reminds me that I noticed that becoming a parent meant that I didn't take things personally the same way I did before, and taking care of someone else became more important than being preoccupied or defining myself certain ways. Beautiful, thank you. I think that's a very good point you're bringing up. And then I've known plenty of people who have taken this insight into, you know, things aren't personal, and applied it in a artificial way to their life, rather than real insight and understanding, use it as a way of escaping or withdrawing, not taking responsibility, and being aloof or separate or something. And certainly we don't want to do that. I think that we don't want to use that insight to hold back. We just want to use that insight so we don't weigh down by what happens to us in our life. But then you want to respond in healthy ways, and if there's a wrong, if there's a transgression or a conflict, it's a lot easier to take care of it if you don't take it personally. But you want to take care of it and talk about it. You don't want to walk away from it and say, well, that has nothing to do with me. That's very good. You know, that taking things personally is something we add to the situation. And so is it necessary to, it's not inherent in the situation. It's always something we add. So is it something that is necessary to add? And I think what Ken's pointing out is that if he just stays right in the moment, that he frees himself from adding a lot of extra stuff to what's happening, and then it's easier to take things, not take it personally. Or to not take things personally is already, maybe can be another thing you do, right? I'm not going to take this personally, you know, kind of. But there can also be the absence of taking things personally. Do you see the difference? So if you're really in the present moment and really see clearly, there can be an absence of taking things personally, and there can be a lot of peace. Yeah. It all points to how we make a bigger story out of things. You know, don't make a big story out of things can be almost the same as don't take it personally. Yes. So I hope all of you will investigate a little bit this issue of taking things personally and see how you can use this investigation so to be a little bit freer and more peaceful and more helpful for the world around you. The beautiful thing about the Buddhist teachings and kind of not taking things personally is that it goes side by side with a tremendous emphasis on personal responsibility or self-responsibility. So how do you negotiate in a way that brings peace, the balance between not taking things personally but also taking personal responsibility for things? Where's that balance, or how do you take personal responsibility without taking it personally? So may the investigation help all of us be happier and more peaceful and be more trusting in the great silence, the great stillness, which is so nurturing, and in the end be more helpful to our fellow humans. So I'll see you all in about a month, and I wish you all well. Bye-bye.